Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 2nd, 2002. Today's session is titled Dirty Theology, Reaffirming the Christian Earth Care Tradition, Session 2, The Bible and Nature, Exciting News from Genesis and Beyond. And it is presented by Paul Santmeier. The number is SAP 2002-02. Let's listen in.
We are continuing our explorations of dirty theology, reaffirming the Christian earth care tradition. Each of these sessions is intended to be a unit in itself, so you can come for one or come for all, although hopefully you will want to come for all to get the whole picture. Yesterday we reviewed the ecological complaint against Christianity, particularly the critique of Lynn White, saying that Christianity only has a God who is transcendent and is very focused on the human creature and accents dominion over the earth, and leading to exploitation and the environmental crisis. And also we looked at Rosemary Radford Ruther and her hypothesis that Christianity emerged into the world in the context of a culture that had an alienated consciousness that presupposed a hierarchical structure of the world with spirit over matter, male over female, humans over slaves, and humans over nature. Now I want to ask you to put all that out of your mind. And invite you now on an exciting adventure to explore some biblical themes. I don't do this afresh. I have my presuppositions. I've been working on this for 30, 35 years. I grew up in the church. I love the Lord Jesus. I mean, all those kinds of things are really important for me. So I have all sorts of assumptions that I bring with me to this study, but I hope that we can conclude at the end of this hour, where we're going to do a sort of a rush through the whole Bible, that there is an approach to understanding nature in the Bible that is very exciting, particularly for those of us who are concerned about earth care and earth saving and indeed cosmological issues. And that's where we are today. I have before me to begin a book. This is... What is this?
The Holy Bible.
The Holy Bible. And what's this book about?
God's story.
Bingo. Now, frequently it takes about 10 minutes to get to that answer. I mean, that's one way, and that's the way we're going to approach this. The other way is, you know, you go up into your room, you shut your eyes, and you page through, and you come up with the text. What is God saying to me today? I mentioned yesterday that I advise against this, because if you happen to do that twice, you might come up with one text, and Judas went and hanged himself, and then another text, go thou and do likewise. Simply coming up with text isn't going to help you an awful lot when you're dealing with this book. This is God's story. This is a book about God. This is a macro narrative about a whole story that has a beginning and an ending. And when you open this macro narrative and you get to the beginning, what do you find? Right at the very beginning.
In the beginning.
That figures. Since it's a story about the whole God, a story about God and God's purposes with the whole creation. And what's neat about this story, it's like stories that you tell your kids again and again and again. They know how it's going to come out, right? But they want you to read the story because it's a good story. Now, we happen to know how this one's going to come out. And when we get to the very end of the Bible, how is it going to come out? In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That's the first part of this this macro narrative. And how does it end?
New heaven, new earth.
New heaven, new earth.
There's a new heaven and a new earth. So what you have in this book is a story, God's story, a macro narrative, which has a beginning for the whole world and comes to a conclusion with the whole world. That's one of the assumptions that I'm making as we approach some of these individual texts. So you just can't pull any text out of context. You got to know what the whole story is about. Then there is a second assumption in this macro narrative that God has a special relationship to us humans. Why, on the basis of this macro story, would one want to say that?
He created us in His image.
Created us according to His own image. Okay. Any other reason why would one want to say that? That God has a special relation to humans?
The whole book is about humans.
It's
incarnate.
Pardon?
Because He became incarnate.
Became incarnate in humans. In order to do what?
Save us.
Not necessarily only save us, but we know that personally. We commune with the one who became incarnate. So God has a special relationship with us humans. Another assumption I'm making is that God sends the Son to restore a fallen humanity and to inaugurate a new heavens and a new earth.
In general, God works through history more than through nature.
We'll put this up here as an unfriendly amendment. History and nature. And I'll come back to it. So there's the Alpha and the Omega of the macro narrative. There's God sending His Son, because along here you read in Genesis 2:3 and following, and all Tower of Babel and all those kinds of things, that humans mucked up their lives. So God sends the Son in the middle of the macro narrative to set things straight with humans who had fallen, and also to carry that narrative forward to the Omega, to the new heavens and the new earth. That's another assumption that I'm making about this macro narrative. And then also that a further assumption is that God sends the Spirit. And by the way, the Son is not, the sending of the Son is incarnate here, but it's not as if the Word made flesh was not here before, because in the beginning, John 1:1 was the Word, and the Word was with God. Mm-hmm. And according to Genesis 1, God spoke the Word, and the world came into being. So the Word was active all along in creation. God also sent the Spirit to connect all these things and make them happen. In the 21st chapter of Genesis 1:1, what's the picture there? Let's see if we can do some research here in Genesis 1:1. If you have your Bibles, let's look at that. Let's see, 2. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. Now, there, mine has a footnote there. Who has a translation that says wind? Okay, which is your translation?
NRSV.
The New Revised Standard Version. This is the Revised Standard Version that says the Spirit. It's the same word, ruach, that's used here. Is there any reason why we wouldn't want to translate this Spirit? I think there's good reason to translate this Spirit. That from the very beginning, God speaks His Word, which then becomes flesh in the fullness of time. And God then also sends the Spirit to hover. And the image is almost of a mother bird sitting on her nest. That this word hover, as if to give birth to things. Okay, so assumption is that God sends the Son, the Word that He spoke at the beginning, to become incarnate in order to restore humans to their place in this macro narrative that God wanted in the first place, because we messed it up so much. And then from the beginning, the same Spirit was God sent in order to connect things and energize things and sort of make it happen. And that Spirit also comes out in abundance around the incarnation in the time of Pentecost. The Spirit, I would also like to think, helps beautify things, you know, connects things. And if we had you know, some weeks to go through this material, we would notice in Genesis 1 that there's it's a kind of a liturgical chant almost. That certain things, you know, how it's easier in Vespers just to let the choir do the other part and you do the sort of the simple part. What is the simple part that's repeated again and again?
It's good.
And God saw that it was good. And God saw that it was good. And God saw that it was good. And then that ends up with this beautiful project. And some of you may have heard African American preachers talk about this text. And God saw that it was good. And God looked at this world. And He said, "This is a world that I really want, that I dearly love, that I want to take to my breast and cherish," said the Lord. "It is good." And at the end of this creative project that launches this whole macro history, God steps back from this, and what does He say? It is
very good.
Very good. It is very good. You know, I remember when I finally fixed the plumbing in my farmhouse in Maine, the copper piping. I won't tell you some of the things that I said along the way, as every time I'd solder it and go, pss, pss, and the water would come out. I finally fixed it. I said, "That's good. I mean, I did some good. I finally fixed that copper tubing." Well, all the more so, God looked at the whole world, this glorious thing. And I dare say it is through the working of the Spirit that it is so beautiful. That when you go out of this building and you look up here and you look up there and you see all that beauty, that's the work of the Spirit. When you look into each other's faces and you smile at each other, that's the work of the Spirit to beautify, to bring it to the point where God can... God the Father can say, "That's good." So that, why God sent the Spirit, and then finally the assumption that God gathers a particular group of people to tell all this stuff. There was ancient Israel and the church, and we're called together. I mean, isn't this incredibly good news that we know about a creator that had a purpose for the whole world? who is working to bring it to fulfillment, the new heavens and the new earth. And even though we messed up, he sent his Son and the fullness of the Spirit. In the meantime, without merit or worthiness in us, the Spirit is doing all this beautiful stuff all around us and showing us, you know, when you smile at someone, they smile back. And the Spirit is doing all this. And isn't it great and good and gracious? And we want to tell everybody about it. I remember an occasion at our farmhouse in Maine. It had just rained, and I was there by myself. For some reason, the kids and the wife were there. And I went outside, and I saw a rainbow. I'm saying, my God, a rainbow, look at that. And then I wanted to tell somebody. My wife wasn't there, my kids weren't there. And finally, I went out on the road, and I stopped the car. And I said, look at the rainbow. We know all this. And so God calls together a group of people and says, look at the rainbow. So that's my assumption about what this macro narrative is all about. And you got to keep that in mind when you come to these individual texts, which are all in one way or another contributing to this overall story. Okay, let's plunge in. Let's look at Genesis 1 in particular. Genesis 1 is a priestly micro-narrative. That's how I'm going to toss this other term in for you. You know, when you... Oh, you've all been to weddings, right? And somebody stands up, maybe the father of the bride, somebody else, and says, well, I want to greet the family of the groom. You know, I want to say now that two families are coming together. Now, I won't comment on that as to where all those dynamics are and whether two families are really coming together even though they fought a lot beforehand and stuff like this, but think of that kind of moment where you bring two families together, each with their own set of histories and stories to tell, and now they're supposed to be one family. Well, that's how this macro narrative came together. There are a lot of micro narratives sort of more discreet and more specifically located stories that were put together to be part of this overall narrative of God's work with the whole creation. And one of them was the priestly narrative, which the setting of this is important, the historical setting for us to know. Presumably shaped, ancient material, shaped by these so-called priestly writers in Babylon when the Hebrew people were in exile. Now, what was life like in Babylon for the Hebrew people?
They were slaves.
Slaves of whom?
Babylonians.
Babylonians, but not just any old Babylonians, but the high king. It was an authoritarian absolute monarchy type thing. The word of the king was Lord. So the world in which this story of Genesis 1 was put together was a world in which a king would issue orders and things would happen. It was also a world united and held together by the economics of irrigation. And I was mentioning this yesterday. I thought of this when we were driving up by the Columbia River, and I saw, you know, isn't it amazing that you have the cherry orchards there and the apple orchards or whatever else is growing there, because someone figured out how to do irrigation. Well, the whole of Babylonian society was held together by an economy of irrigation. It was a garden society, but it was only green because of irrigation, and it was the irrigation could only happen because there, I should say only happen, but it did happen because of an authoritarian political structure where the king could say to his lieutenants, do this, and they would build the, channel out the irrigation ditches and all the rest. That was the setting, and you might think of it as building a civilization. This was where the Hebrew writers were located socially and politically. So the image of the divine king is very much to the fore in Genesis 1. God speaks when it happens, And also the role of the human created in the image of God is like that king, created to rule. That's the way the Babylonians did it. So that is the setting, and those are some of the themes that emerge. But I want to show you now how there is a subversive faith going on in the midst of this setting where the great king, the creator of the world, speaks and the world comes into being, and where the human is set to rule over the earth and to subdue the earth. I've called it in my notes here a holistic micro-narrative. First of all, one of the things that's going on here with regard to the divine king, who is this divine king in Genesis 1? What do we know about this divine king?
He speaks and it happens.
Speaks and it happens, that there's power. That's true. What else do you know? This is sort of a trick question because it's not in the text. In terms of the setting, some of the other, let me see if I can tease this answer
out. Liturgical.
Pardon?
I said there's a sense of a structure or order or liturgy.
Okay, there's some. It's a liturgical thing, and Genesis 1 may well have been, in its early stages, a liturgical chant about the whole creation. If we had more time, what I would try to tease out of you is that some of the other literature at the same time that this from Babylon, one of the other pieces was the book of Ezekiel. Now, the image of God we have in the book of Ezekiel from the same set of priestly writers, can you remember anything from Ezekiel that might be illuminating of how we think of God?
I know.
There's some fantastic stuff going on in Ezekiel. Okay, there's that. Do you perchance remember Ezekiel talking about the shepherds? And that the shepherds of the people were not taking good care of them. They had trouble with the clergy in those days as well. And so God himself was going to become the shepherd of his people. God himself was going to care for them and take care of them. So God has, in Ezekiel, God has this image of being the caring one who seeks out the lost. Now, could that be this taken for granted here in Genesis 1, where you have this king of power issuing words? Well, possibly so. In fact, I think it's likely so that something subversive is going on here, that it's not just power, the priestly writers are saying to the Babylonians, it is love, caring. Our God is God who cares for this whole thing and indeed wants to make it a place of blessing for all creatures. So that's one subversive element. There are others as well. Without sneaking a peek at your text, do you remember what day of the 6 days the animals were created?
Fifth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, you can peek if you want to. What day was the human created? The human was created as sort of the apex of creation. What day was that? Seven is, we all know what seven is. Seven is the day he rested, so Sabbath and all that stuff. So it must have been six that the human was created.
The animals were six also. The birds and the fish.
Now, isn't it interesting that this text, which is supposed to, by its critics, supposed to be all about humans, on the sixth day, God creates the humans and the animals together. And indeed, in the Hebrew, both are called a nefesh hayah, that is, a living soul. God creates the animals as a living soul. God creates the humans as a living soul. There is a kind of solidarity between humans and animals. That, to me, really qualifies this notion of rule, the radah, as to perhaps being a different kind of rule than the Babylonian authoritarian rule. Rather, there's a subversive element here of solidarity between humans and animals. And by the way, as an aside, the fellowship of humans and animals continues down into the 18th and 19th century, except for royalty, and more often than not, royalty included. People in the West always lived with their animals in the same house. You know, with the manger scene of Jesus, that it was no accident that there was no room for him in the inn, and he probably ended up in a peasant house, which was a square house with a divider in the middle, and the animals on one side, and the people on the other. And so they said, "Well, we've got a room here, Joseph, but you could stay in the other half of the house where the animals are." So people have always lived with animals. Common people have. And that's reflected here in this text. So there are some subversive elements going on in this Genesis 1 text, as well as this grand vision of delight that God has in the whole creation, suggesting that God has a purpose for the whole creation, not just for humans. Bertrand Russell once said that if God was all so darn interested in human beings, why do we have all the ichthyosaurs and dinosaurs? Why didn't God get to the point right away? Well, maybe the point, Bertrand Russell, was that God wasn't so all interested in human beings. God had a purpose for the whole creation, and each day is good. And then at the very end, and what does God look at when he says it's very good? Someone check out 131.
Everything that he saw,
and it's very, very good. Now, there have been some Christian teachers, like Ambrose, a teacher of St. Augustine, who said, God looked at the human creature, and behold, saw that everything was good. No, Ambrose. The text said God looked at the whole of his creation. So there's a lot of, if you take the Babylonian setting where there's sheer power being enacted here, there are some resonances of that in terms of the picture of God as being one with authority and speaks his word, and with the humans having a certain sense of ruling. And by the way, let's not get sentimental about this. Have you ever dug a ditch? I mean, it takes work. You know, you got to get in there. And I used to, as a college student, I worked as a ditch digger. This was before backloaders and stuff like this. And it takes a lot of work. And if you're going to build a civilization, you got to move things around. You know, irrigation, make roads. I mean, however ecologically sensitive this particular community is, you still got those big trucks. You know, and you got to move the snow and the stones and all that. I mean, you got to move things around. The question is what is the framework you do it in? So that's Genesis 1, the priestly narrative set in a royal Babylonian setting, but subversive in its own way, saying that God has purposes for the whole creation, that God, let me, as an aside here, just for your further study, if you're looking for something to read for a Bible reading before you go to bed tonight, read Psalm 104. It's a great long psalm, but it's really a commentary on Genesis 1. And in that commentary on Genesis 1, we hear about the sea monsters. And God, do you happen to know why God created the sea monsters? According to Psalm 104?
In the support of it.
Ah, we got a ringer in the group. It's like Psalm 104, verse 21, something like that. That's the way it's usually translated, for the sport of it. It could be translated to play with them. It also could be translated, and I think more appropriately so, to rejoice in them, you know? Wow, you know, here's the sea monsters. And this reflects back on Genesis 1, where God takes delight in all his creatures. I like to think of the sea monsters, if you have problems with sea monsters, I always read their galaxies. Why did God create all the billions of galaxies? I mean, never mind that we're like grasshoppers here on this planet, and just Johnny come lately in the whole history of evolution, and you know, we just made it because we got the thumb that came to the finger, and we had got a little bigger head on our shoulders. We just barely made it on Earth, never mind that. All the billions of galaxies. Why did God create all these billions of galaxies? Well, I like to think of, whenever I read sea monsters in the scriptures, I substitute the word galaxies, because that's, the sea monsters were the greatest and biggest creatures that the people of the time knew. God made the galaxies to play with them.
Isn't it also the case, I mean, in the Babylonian context, I mean, the Babylonian deities were sea monsters, so God creates sea monsters, or setting the record straight, God created.
Okay, the good point that's being made here is that there's some not so subtle criticism going on against the Babylonian deities, some of which were sea monsters. Sometimes goddesses and gods of chaos, and the sea monsters had to be slain. Chaos had to be overcome in order to have an orderly world. Well, in this text, there's no suggestion of any real struggle like that. But the writer may well be poking fun. I mean, a little bit of my God is better than your God. I mean, you have these goddesses, these of the chaos called sea monsters, and our God sort of has fun with them, you know, plays with them. So that may well be going on there.
There is toys.
Excuse me?
There is toys.
I didn't hear what you said.
There is toys.
Toys.
God's toys.
Oh, God's toys. Yeah, possibly. You know, like cat with a mouse, maybe. I would prefer to massage the interpretation in a different direction, however, that God, in the notion of delight and rejoice and that kind of thing. But that can be debated. Now, I want to move on to another micro-narrative, and that is Genesis 2. We have at least two creation narratives in the scriptures. The folks who put the Bible together put Genesis 1, that is the priestly writer, around the 550 B.C. first, good reasons, that he wanted to talk about the creation of the whole world, and Genesis 2, which is a creation story, doesn't evidently talk about the creation of the whole world. You sort of begin with stuff, and there's water burgling out of the underneath the ground, and now you see Yahweh. This is called the Yahwistic account, Yahweh the Lord, and the priestly writers tended to use other names for God. Don't worry about these particular names. They're just sort of words that scholars have chosen to help identify this material. But Genesis 2 is an account of its own, and it's set in a setting that is not now a royal Babylonian type setting, but think back to the time of the United Kingdom and King David and Solomon, and a kind of Homeric mind, bringing these stories together about the origins of human life, with the strong memory not being the new kingdom of David and Solomon, but what went before. Now, can anyone dig back into some dusty corner of your mind and what was Israelite society with before the coming of kingship in David and Solomon around the year 1000 B.C.?
Separate tribes.
Judges
to rule them.
Judges, right. And economically, how did they get by? They didn't have irrigation systems. They didn't have kings to do all that kind of stuff. How did they get by? How do you imagine they got by?
Or not. Herding animals?
I can't hear you.
Herding animals?
Herding animals, yeah. And farming. That's the way they squeezed by. It wasn't the elegant society that was later to come in Babylon when the world became green because of irrigation. It was a very tough life, an agricultural life, as agricultural life traditionally has been. And the memory, the strong memory that informed the people of those times was the agricultural life of the tribes and the peoples as they struggled to get enough food and wherewithal to have their community lives. So we have an agricultural setting now for Genesis 2. And lo and behold, we have something that is not like anything that the people would have remembered, unless they thought way back to Egypt, where there was Egypt was a green zone because of its own kind of overflowing of the Nile and that kind of thing. They have a garden, and it's called Eden. Do you know what that word means? There's a footnote to it here in my Bible. It's the place of delights. It's an agricultural mind now thinking, you know, what would it really be like if I didn't have to work so hard by the sweat of my brow to get food and from the plants and to deal with the pests and to deal with the marauding bandits and all those kinds of animals that would come after my sheep and my goats and so forth. What would it have been like? It would have been this wonderful garden where there's peace and we didn't have to worry about these things. So that's the setting. And 2:15, the Lord God, I don't want to get there yet. Here we are. There's a mist. This is 2:6. The mist goes up from the earth, waters the whole face of the ground. Then the God formed man of dust from the ground. And we know this man's name is to be Adam, and he came from the ground. And there's probably a footnote in your text, as it is in mine, that the ground, the name of the ground in Hebrew is
Adama.
So Adam is, here's the justification for this dirty theology. Adam is of the earth, a creature of the earth, becomes a living being. And then the garden is described in some length. And then 2:15, I'm reading now from the Revised Standard Version. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to till it and keep it. Now, if you were here yesterday, you already got a sneak preview of the remark I want to make. Now, this is a profoundly wrong translation. We can speculate why translators may have wanted to do this, but the Hebrew literally says, "To the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to serve it and to protect it." So in this agricultural setting, I mean, I do a little gardening myself, I'm sure most of you do. You know, you have the seedling, you know. I mean, I die for that thing to grow. I put it in there and I just do everything I possibly can to encourage it. And if it's a little tree, put a stake next to it and I carefully tie it and I try to keep protected from the wind and insects and stuff like that. So if you're a family farmer, you know all about caring for creation. You're not about to dominate things. You've got to really care for these things, and that's the kind of ethos that is coming forward here, and you want to protect it. You want to care for the earth and protect it. Yeah.
The word keep, though, is used in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. In the Portland, Oregon area, we've got a very active group called the Tualatin River Keepers. And they spend their whole time taking care of the Tualatin River.
Mm-hmm.
And they take the rubbish out. They basically protect it.
Mm-hmm.
Same as beekeepers. Okay. If you've ever kept bees and you don't own those bees,
that's right.
You give them a house, you let them go about their business, and you try and keep them out of danger.
That's right.
And yeah, you move them to wherever you want to get your flowers.
But it's a horizontal relationship and an interactive, and indeed one that you step back from.
So with that in mind, the word keep does not bother me.
It doesn't bother you if we're using it in that sense. It means protect. But in this capitalistic society, keep. Every kid wants to, you know, keep what is his or hers, you know. And so we have to really massage the meaning. If you think of beekeeping, that's great. I think it's something like that. So now you have, in this micro-narrative, you have yet another take on the person, what God envisions for us to be our relationship to the earth, and I think a boost for, if I might say so, the family farm. I don't see much of this kind of caring going on in agribusiness. But that's another discussion for another time. So you have in the priestly micro-narrative, yes, a certain rule and a certain will to subdue, but for the sake of building up a civilization and in a way that cares for the whole so it can be a place of delight, because every creature has its own value in the eyes of God. And now in this micro-narrative, you have this, in this agricultural setting, you have the sense of really caring for and keeping or protecting the earth in that sense. One other thing in this micro-narrative that I alluded to, and I want to disabuse you of the idea I gave you yesterday, comes in verse 2:19. So out of the ground of the... formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called every living creature, that was its name. Now, I was taught in seminary by a scholar who was well informed by the history of religions that naming is a way of exerting power over. That's, quote, that's what it typically means in the history of religion. Well, maybe, but is that what's going on here? If you look at this text, first of all, come from the basis of your own experience. Those of you who are parents, you know, or if you have a pet, and what was your naming an act of power? Wasn't it more an act of bonding? You know? I mean, what's going on here? And as a matter of fact, if you jump all the way to the Gospel of John, and the greatest thing that Jesus says, I've called you friends, there's a naming going on there, or throughout the Old Testament, God gives Israel a name, because Israel is God's beloved. And there is a sense here that you notice the picture in this wonderful mythological, mythic image here of this primeval scene, that God, as it were, steps back. Let's see. So he brought them to the man to see what he would call them. God saying, let's see if these creatures can bond. You know? See how Adam will interrelate with other kind here. I think that's a very possible reading and a good reading of this text, that naming is here intended to be an act of bonding and affection rather than an act of power. And that would also go with the notion of Adam being put in the garden. Why?
Protect the garden.
To, let's say it together, class.
To serve.
Keep, care for. Okay, serve. To serve and protect. Okay. Why was Adam put in the garden, according to Genesis 2, class? To serve and to protect. Not to till and keep. Okay. And I think that if when in the course of your conversations with people who don't know as much about this stuff as you do, they tell you, well, of course, Adam named these things and exercised power, you say, well, no, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Okay, that's another micro-narrative. I want to go to a couple more, but let me stop here and see if we have any kinds of questions, clarifications, or objections about anything I've said about the macro narrative of the whole Bible and this micro narrative of the priestly matters and now the Yahwistic agricultural things.
This animal naming thing, it is in the context of finding a suitable companion.
Mm-hmm.
For Adam.
Yeah, there's a playfulness about this. God, do you think God knew that how this was going to come out?
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's humorous.
Yeah.
Know,
I mean,
he's looking at this. Adam goes, well, that's not really what.
Well, it's not what he really.
Then he finds the right thing, and he goes, yeah, okay.
Eureka!
Right.
Yeah, right. And we don't have time now to get into this whole rib theology and Eve being the font of all evil and things like this. But suffice to say that don't you usually save the best to last?
Yeah.
Well, and even if you want to go with the name thing, he doesn't get to name her. She already comes named.
That's right.
And then in Hebrew, the names switch when she's around. When she's there, then it's no longer Adam, it's Ish and Isha, it's man and woman.
That's right. That's well taken.
Yeah.
well taken. So if we were talking more about anthropology, that is understanding of human creature, we would spend a lot more time on this. Let me go, I want to touch lightly one other major bunch of material in the Old Testament that you really should be acquainted with if you're not, or revisit if you haven't visited for a long time, and then touch very lightly on a couple of New Testament things. So you got this whole picture, the macro narrative of God creating the world that has purposes for all things, sending the Son, the Spirit to sort of weave it all together to bring it toward final fulfillment. And one of the things, one of the premises I state is that God is interested in the whole creation, not just humans. He's interested in sea monsters and the creeping things and all the rest. And one illustration of this otherness is here now in the Jobian, that is Job tradition, which comes roughly from the same kind of cultural setting the priestly narrative did. And let's turn to Job 38 and 39. You mostly know Job because of his adamant protest to the Lord of all the things that had happened to him. You mostly know Job, and we all can identify Job, and we're encouraged to identify with Job because he raises his righteous indignation against the Lord for all his sufferings, and that is going on. But what else is going on that you may not know or not be totally familiar with is the God of Job, the God who speaks from the whirlwind, has a lot of interests as well as just Job. And if you look at Job 38, this now begins the Lord's answer to Job out of the whirlwind. Verse 4, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." And then goes on a whole narration of God the Creator doing all these wonderful things with the galaxies and all the rest. And let me just call your attention to a couple of them. Job 38:22. "Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail? Have you gone up and walked on the glaciers?" I mean, you've got to be out of your mind to do that. But God is at home there. Then 38:39. "Can you hunt the prey for the lion, or satisfy the appetite of the young lions when they crouch in their dens or lie in wait in their hiding place, their covert?" You know, nature, friends, is not Bambi. When you go out on a hike, as I did today, even a simple flat one the way I did, you really got to be careful. It's not a terribly friendly place. We're just at the edge of the wilderness, and you know there are path markers and signs and protections and everything. But once you go beyond that, you're likely to get in big trouble very soon. But God is doing all sorts of stuff out there. God cares for these lions. Now, when we get to talking about evolution tomorrow, we want to talk about how God relates to evolution and death and suffering in nature. We'll reserve that for a conversation tomorrow. But this vision of Job now, the writer of Job, is that God has this relationship with the lions, with the nature red in tooth and claw. Is that a signal from the Lord? Okay, I've still got 7 minutes, Lord. 39:15. Where is that's the ostrich? Where is the? It's 40:15. Chapter 40:15. Behold, Behemoth, which I made, as I made you, he eats grass like an ox. This was presumably some kind of, maybe the hippopotamus, maybe some other creature like that that's now extinct. Behold his strength in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs like bars of iron. One evening, my wife and I were driving along a highway. This was late at night, and we were sort of singing and trying to keep ourselves awake so we wouldn't fall asleep at the wheel. And we were joking about things that we had never seen a moose where we were. Even though some of the neighbors had seen moose all the time, but we had never seen a moose. And we were just joking about that and said, I'm sure there's no moose around here. And just then a moose steps out in front of us. I screeched to a halt. I mean, have you ever stood next to a moose? I mean, they are monstrous creatures. And something like that sense of awe for these creatures of God is going here with Job. And then 41:1, we return to the Leviathan.
I think you should read verse 19.
Okay, verse 19 of
what you're talking about.
Of chapter 40?
Yeah.
He is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountains yield food for him, where all the wild beasts play.
I guess that mine says he ranks first among the works of God.
Yeah.
I thought that was us.
That's right. Don't you feel a little?
Yeah.
When you read texts like this? Of course, on the other hand, when you go out for a walk the way I did today, I feel a little too. And I should. And then coming to the Leviathan now in 41:1. Can you draw Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Well, this would suggest the more sporting attitude toward Leviathan, that God, the creator of all things, can just do what he wants with the galaxies. You know, go there, galaxy. And there it goes. This is the picture of God. And it's almost as if we humans are not a part of this. There's this whole vast world of glory called wilderness, or whatever you want to call it, other kind, where God has all these purposes and things that God is up to that we just don't know about. Now, if we're going to talk about Job any longer, we have to talk about what the point of God's speech is to Job and how it relates to Job's suffering and everything else. But whatever else is going on in the book of Job, you have this sense of wilderness, wildness, as being something that God is interested in. And this, brothers and sisters, I think has some ramifications for our ethics and the kind of world that we want to envision we want to live in. Do you want to live in a world where there's no wilderness? Well, I know. I think God placed us in a world with wilderness. Okay, now, if we had more time, and I'll come back to some of this tomorrow, and I will come back to it at 3:45 p.m., plug, 3:45 p.m., we would go into yet another micro-narrative of this whole story here from St. Paul. And let me just give you a flavor of that. Paul is looking at
if you think of the lions and the leviathans and all the rest and all the creation, turn to Romans 8 now. And, you know, what's going to happen to this this world? Acts, Romans, right? And it's 8:20-19. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God, for the children of God. That is, hopefully we will get our act together through Jesus Christ our Lord, and we humans will then be on the way to the kingdom to come. In the meantime, the creation, which was subjected to futility, and we can talk about that another time, the creation itself, when it all comes together, will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the glorious liberty of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning and travail together until now, and not only the creation, but we ourselves who are the first fruits of the Spirit. So one of the things that's going on here now in this macro narrative is that Paul is sort of looking at the whole thing, you know, the sea monsters and all the powers and principalities, and saying whatever else has been going on there through Jesus Christ has opened up a new world where the whole creation is going to be redeemed. And likewise for Revelations, Book of Revelation, chapter 21, where we have another expression of this eschatological micro-narrative of the New Testament, where you see the whole history of God coming together, being renewed. Sometimes as a pastor, I used to deal with questions of grief with people who had a pet die. Now, this is not taught in seminaries. But, you know, there's real grief. And the question that's in the back of people's minds is Fritz going to be in heaven? You know, I mean, when I get to heaven, you know, I'm going to be dogs and cats and stuff like this. Well, I think there's good biblical basis for a pastoral praxis to say, you know, Fritz the dog is going to be there as much as anybody else is going to be. That there's going to be new heavens and a new earth. The leviathans are going to be there. The galaxies are going to be there. It's not just us human creatures. Now, there's going to be some glorious things in store for us, because there's going to be a new Jerusalem. Righteousness and peace and beauty and all these things. But from Fritz the dog to the lions, and of course, we know from Isaiah 11... who is the lion going to be sleeping with? The lion. It's going to be a world of peace. And in many ways, it will fulfill the promise of creation. And I didn't mention this when we were dealing with Genesis 1, but let me mention it now. That the human creature was created to be a vegetarian. And fulfillment is when the lion lays down with the lamb, and there won't be any violence anymore. Now, the biblical witness itself is a little askew on this, because if you read in Isaiah 19 or 26, anyway, that's the text that's read on Easter Sunday, where the fulfillment's going to be a feast of fat things and wine in the lees. Well, no. But it's going to be a world of peace. And this is the way Paul and John, the seer in the Book of Revelation, put it together. That all creatures who are created and valued by God, in the midst of whom we were placed,
yes, to build up civilization, but also to sensitively care for them and protect them and to stand back and wonder at them, all is going to be brought together in one world of heavenly peace beyond this current world, which will be the consummation of the world. You have heard the whole Bible. Now, as I said yesterday, you can hear how much I truly enjoy talking about all this stuff. I'm around all the time. We can't have a conversation now as I would like to have, so grab me, sit at the table with me, and let's talk some more about this, and bring your questions tomorrow at 3:45, where we'll talk about Christ, evolution, and the cosmos. Thank you for coming.